Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to this program May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. She's a scientist who studies insects. And occasionally she is here, usually in the warmer times of the year, to talk about bugs and how they live their lives. And as I always explain when she is here, see, we do two kind of programs. When May is here, we encourage people to ask questions, but to try to make friends with the bugs. Now, if you can't make friends with them and you must get rid of them, we have a guy for that, Phil Nixon, whose specialty is getting rid of the bugs.
He actually is a love
the bugs guy. And one of the things that I appreciate him, well, yeah, but he, I think one of the things I really appreciate about Phil is that he often begins by saying, well, is this something that you can live with? And if you can, well, leave them alone. And then if you absolutely can't, well, he'll tell you what to do. But we save the extermination kind of questions for another day. And instead, when May is here on the program, we say, well, you know, let's indulge our curiosities because bugs, insects, are really interesting. There's huge variety, and sometimes they can be pretty cool. So that's what we do when May is here. And generally about this time of year, for a while, she has been here on the program to talk about what has now become such a huge event, a world-famous event. It's really it's overshadowing the Oscars now. And that is the Insect Fear Film Festival, 24th year now this year. That's something that she started here on the campus of the University of Illinois to, first of all, just to have some fun, to watch some silly movies, but also to give people the opportunity actually maybe to learn some stuff about insects. And it's going to happen on Saturday, this coming Saturday. And she will talk a little bit about what you can see. And, of course, if people do have, we can do the usual things that we do when she's here on the program. If you have insect questions, you can call us, and I know she'll do her best to answer. Sometimes we say to people, well, if there's something that you've seen and you're not sure what it is, if you can give us a description, the best description that you can, she may be able to say, yes, I can tell you what that is. It's sometimes pretty tough because she can't see it, and you know the descriptions sometimes are not real good. But you can, but you can do that. Any and all of that is bug talk. Here is that what we're doing here on the program. So 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It's nice to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
Once again, why don't you just tell the story? I'm sure you've told the story before about how it is that you even thought about starting the festival. Now back in 1984.
Yep, that was our first one. Well, it all started. I was a small child. No, actually, I was a graduate student at Cornell in entomology. Well, actually, in ecology and evolutionary biology, but I was interested in insects. And I was walking on campus, and I noticed a poster advertising a Godzilla festival sponsored by the Asian American Student Society. And I thought, well, if Asian American students can have a sense of humor about their identity, why can't entomologists? So I went to the department and proposed the idea of having an insect fear film festival where we show, you know, movies about, you know, insect ants the size of mobile homes in the sewers of Los Angeles, and then explain to people why what they see can't possibly happen. And the department head there thought that was undignified and inappropriate, and that we could show some documentaries, and that was not the point at all. So I kind of shelved the idea till I came here to the University of Illinois and, you know, worked a couple of years to establish my credentials as a, you know, legitimate insect scientist, and then went to my department head here, who not only thought it was a great idea, but thought we should charge admission and maybe get a teaching assistantship out of it or something. But I think charging admission probably would defeat the whole purpose of encouraging people to come. So he was totally supportive. And then the next obstacle I faced was how to put together a film festival. Nothing in my background prepared me for that. So I sent a note to the director of the Unit for Cinema Studies asking if they, here on campus, if they'd be interested in co-sponsoring the event. And the director of the unit gave it to the assistant director, you know, all these sort of bothersome letters. So the assistant director wrote a very nice letter back explaining that the unit was very busy with a series of French and German retrospectives, but he'd be very happy to help me find the films and secure the rights and in general put on the festival. So he was very instrumental in getting this up and running. That was the assistant director at the time is Richard Laskowski. And let's see, I guess 5 years later, I married him. So Insect Fear Film Festival, in addition to spreading the word about insect biology, has had a major impact on my life.
Feel the love. The Insect Fear Film Festival. Yes, sir.
And actually, we called it – we were ambitious when we called it the first annual because we didn't know if it would even work. And next year will be our 25th. This is our 24th. And I think since imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, it's really interesting to note that there are now – insect outreach events at most of the departments of entomology at land-grant universities, but we actually started this tradition. And as far as I know, ours is the longest continuously running public university celebration of insects. I can't say longest running public celebration of insects because there is a honeybee festival in Paris, Illinois, that started a year before we did. There is a woolly worm festival in Banner Elk, North Carolina, that started the year before that. And there is the Festival of the Phylloxera in a town in Spain that is also venerable. So that's where people dress up as plant lice and drink a lot of champagne, actually.
Seriously? Yeah. Plant lice?
Yeah. Well, Phylloxera, as it turns out, this is a it's a related to aphid, a type of aphid, actually, that feeds on the sap of grapes, and the grape phylloxera in any case. And around 1860s in France, the finest vineyards in the world were absolutely devastated by the sudden appearance of grape phylloxera, which just completely destroyed Vitis vinifera, the European grape. It turns out it was an accidental introduction from North America because, as it turns out, North American grapes are resistant to phylloxera. They don't make great wine. Vitis labrusca has kind of got this off flavor. So Charles Valentine Riley, USDA entomologist at the time, had the brilliant idea of importing American rootstocks to graft the European grapes onto and basically saved French wine for the rest of the world. They're still growing on those American rootstocks. He got the French Legion of Honor for his contributions to French culture, which was basically saving the grapes. So this was all through Europe. So there's this is a sort of a red letter day, I guess, in European history. It was the day that phylloxera were defeated. So,
oh, so that's why the Spanish they're celebrating the defeat. It's not that they were celebrating the fact that the French wine crop was wiped out.
No, I think this is the area of Spain where Freixenet, which is champagne is manufactured. So they were also affected. It's estimated that a third to half of all of Europe's vineyards were just destroyed by this tiny little plant louse. So those who don't respect the power of insects come to regret that. Mm-hmm. And that's what the festival's all about. Mm-hmm. You don't need to have a moth the size of apartment building to wreak havoc with the economy. A little tiny louse that feeds on the roots of grapes can do it just as nicely.
All right. May Barenbaum is here. She's head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois and was the person who, in 1984, started the Insect Fear Film Festival and will be going on this coming weekend on Saturday. And she started out with the idea that you could have some fun and you could show some goofy movies about great big insects terrorizing the countryside, but also at the same time actually give people some accurate information about insects and for example, explain to people why, no, of course, you can't have an ant that size. It just doesn't work. You can't do it. And it's free and open to the public and is suitable. I think it looks to me like the everything here is suitable for family viewing. I think sometimes in the past you've had some stuff that was a little dicey for the little kids, but this probably it should be okay.
Yeah, even Rebirth of Mothra. Generally, the more recent movies tend to be more graphic, but the Rebirth of Mothra is definitely aimed at a PG audience. And we're featuring this year Japanese insect fear films, at least in part. I mean, we organize around themes to convey a central message. And the central message really is not all cultures view insects with the same revulsion that generally is reserved for them in Western cultures. And in fact, it's interesting. Two of our films feature Mothra, a giant moth, which, you know, is not really, wouldn't probably work very well in American cinema. But Mothra, as it turns out, was beloved and came back to appear in four sequels as the good guy. And really, she's not out to destroy Tokyo. She's just out to help save some friends of hers. And when you see Mothra as a caterpillar, it's clear that she is basically a giant silkworm. And silkworm, Bombyx mori, is is the foundation for the Japanese silk industry, and before that, the Chinese silk industry. So this is an insect that is, you know, has thousands of years of tradition behind it. So, although, and you know, you think about it, one thing that Mothra does is shoot silk at whatever monster is threatening society. And it is pretty awesome stuff, silk. You don't really, people take it for granted, but as natural fibers go, it's truly remarkable. It's stronger than steel. It can support more weight than a sort of a steel cable of comparable dimensions, yet it can stretch for 50% of its length. So it's strong yet elastic. It has what's called a low glass fiber transition temperature. So it remains flexible at very, very low temperatures, which is why silk, although it was spider silk, was used in bomber gun sights, crosshairs of gun sights, mm-hmm. In World War II, because the fibers up at 30,000 feet wouldn't break. It absorbs dyes really well. It self-extinguishes. It doesn't melt like polyester or burst into flame like rayon. It's truly a remarkable material. Of course, in the movies, Mothra also shoots electrical impulses or bolts of electricity out of her antennae. I don't know quite what that's all about, but the silk, even in reality, is pretty awesome. And people will have some opportunities to see real-life silkworms, and we'll have silk cocoons. You know, the cocoon from which the silk fiber comes is a single thread, a half mile long. So we'll see if people can actually unreel the cocoon, see who gets the longest unbroken strand. So those appealing to the competitive instincts out there.
So there will be pregame festivities. All these things. The door opens at 6, mm-hmm. and then there will be the opportunity for people to see exhibits and so forth. And then there'll be
a petting zoo. It's a petting zoo.
Are you going to have some giant Madagascar hissing cockroaches?
Always.
Okay,
yeah.
They make an impression.
Yeah, actually, in Japan, another cultural difference is, you know, very high density. People don't have large spaces in which to live. Insects are very popular pets, and enormous prices are paid for particular, very collectible, very desirable pet insects. Giant rhinoceros beetles, for example. There's one that went for $90,000, a particular mutant variant of a giant rhinoceros beetle. So, you know, they're the perfect pet if you live in a small apartment. So.
I guess it all depends on how you was raised, I suppose. we're open to questions here, by the way, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We can do the usual thing when May is here if you have insect questions, just as long as they're not extermination questions. One of these days, and it won't be all that long, it'll actually be spring, and Phil will come on and we'll do that.
Well, there's always insects around.
Well, now that you mention it, I was asked to ask you to talk some about the lady beetles.
Oh, Harmoniax ridens.
Yeah, and I guess I have wondered this myself, because you start to see these inside, the past couple of years we've seen, seems like, more and more of them, and you start to see them inside, say, in the fall, mm-hmm. and into the winter, and then they pretty much just seem to go away, except in our house, for example, just recently one just showed up. And I'm assuming that, well, first of all, when you're seeing them in the fall and in the winter in large numbers, I'm assuming that these are adults that somehow found a way to get into the house from outside. They were living outside,
right?
And then they're little cracks and stuff. So that's why they come inside. And I'm assuming that they come inside because it's warm, or I don't know, just because.
It's what in mammals is called hibernation, and insects is called diapause. So insects are cold-blooded, and it's you know, not like us. They can't maintain their body temperatures irrespective of the environmental temperatures. So when it gets very cold out, basically they just shut down. All kinds of mechanisms. Some insects actually make antifreeze, and some freeze almost solid, all different ways to get through the winter. And what the ladybugs in general tend to do is, as adults, they form these massive aggregations that are in which to spend the winter. And they shut down most of their metabolic activities. They're kind of in a state of suspended animation. This is why you don't see them crawling around right now. They're in, it's called reproductive diapause. They don't, they're not totally immobile, but they're not interested in eating. They're not interested in reproducing. They're not interested in things that insects are generally interested in. They just sort of huddle together and hang out until conditions warm up enough and the aphids come out outdoors, and then they'll vacate the premises and resume their business outside.
So that that answers one of the questions that we all had, I think, was, are they, if they are indeed hanging out in the walls of our house, and I figured, yeah, there's some place that they're hanging out, are they breeding in there? The answer is no, they're not.
Nope.
So they're just waiting. They're just there just waiting for it to get warm enough so that then they can go back outside.
Right. You know, in Asia, where they're native, they're called Asian multicolored ladybugs. They like to overwinter in cracks and crevices in vertical cliff faces. Here in central Illinois, vertical cliff faces are kind of hard to find. So the reason they come to houses is that the side of a house is the closest thing to a vertical cliff face. So,
and if you happen that your house happens to be of a light color,
then it's even better.
Then it's even better. Yeah.
And they'll find a way in. And it's just like in Asia, they would be in massive aggregations, sort of huddled together with sort of this lowered metabolism, and just wait for conditions to improve, and then they become reactivated and head out. So, I think we've probably talked about them before. This is one of these examples of how no matter how environmentally compatible a pest management approach is supposed to be, there's always an impact. And in fact, these non-native species were brought over repeatedly 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, in an effort. There were supposed to be specialists on arboreal aphids, aphids that live in trees like pecan aphids in the southeast. And as it turns out, they are, I can't say lean, mean killing machines because they are kind of clunky looking, but they are definitely killing machines. Anything that is softer and slower moving than they are, they'll eat. They eat monarch caterpillars. They eat other ladybugs. They're basically cannibals. Nobody likes them anyway. This is not going to endear them. They have done more to undermine the public relations goodwill of ladybugs for centuries. Nobody eats them because they are protected with a noxious defensive compound, which you can taste when they fly into your mouth, and they, if you crush them, it smells bad and makes your fingers smell. So they're very well equipped to resist any efforts at sort of natural forces limiting their number. And wherever they've appeared, native ladybugs have kind of declined, as have native innocuous aphids, as have anything else that they can get their mandibles into.
And just for, I promise I have a caller who will get right to, just and because the thing that sort of struck me and it got me thinking about it the other day was that after having seen, over a period of time, having seen, you know, seen them in reasonably good numbers in the house, the one day comes and it just seems like they're just gone. Then I just see the other day I saw one. That was that one that was hanging out with the others and just decided to go for a walk and suddenly popped out.
Could well be. There's one in every crowd. Now overwintering is a tough deal, and house. I mean, it's a really critical balance. When you're very small, it's really easy to lose water because of the surface area volume ratio. You have a lot of surface area for your size. So if your house is a little too dry, those overwintering aggregations will just die. They won't survive. So this one might have sort of – well, it's been warm recently. Maybe this one is just kind of optimistic. Didn't Didn't hear about Punxsutawney Phil or something.
Oh, it's good. Good. You just thought, hey, okay, it's spring. Let's go.
Yeah, could well. It's well, it hit 50, didn't it? Or in the high 40s, anyway.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, okay.
So maybe this one's just optimistic.
All right. We have a caller. Let's talk with them. Urbana, line one.
Good
Hello?
Morning.
Yes.
Hey.
This question of overwintering reminds me of discussions I had with friends about a month ago. People were saying casually that as warm as January was, they were worried that large numbers of insects would survive and be a problem for gardeners come spring and summer. And I myself went out one January day and was surrounded by a cloud of very tiny, I'm not sure what they were.
Gnats, probably, yeah.
It was just a fog of them, and it was January, very confusing. But just as plants are described by their hardiness zone, they'll live in areas where it gets to 10 below, 10 above, you know, they can't stand a frost. Are there similar hardiness zones for insects?
Absolutely.
Are there bugs that can't survive here because unless they're blown up from somewhere, they just die off, eggs, larvae, adults, everything, because of the weather. And if winters continue the way they've been, are we going to enter into new hardiness zones?
That's actually a really good question. Definitely, we don't entomologists don't call them hardiness zones, but that's exactly what they are. Last week, you might have cursed the sub-zero temperatures, but that's basically what keeps us safe from fire ants, killer bees, all kinds of other species that are essentially sort of semi or subtropical in origin and cannot tolerate the winters. Some of our more conspicuous agricultural pests are blown up from the southerly portions of their range. They don't overwinter here. They actually come up like corn. Some of the corn pests. A corn earworm will be blown up from, or else start a generation from southerly, more southerly distributed individuals that overwinter. So winter protects us from a lot of of entomological unpleasantness. Now you mentioned the changing climate.
Yes.
One of the clearer indicators of the fact that things have gotten warmer are shifts in insect distributions. So there are insects now that are living in places where they've never lived before, and they're successfully overwintering in places where they've never lived before, including some mosquito species. And lots of butterflies have shifted distributions. The records are really good in England. And again, the same pattern keeps appearing where there are sort of northward upper limit shifts that are associated with the changing climate. Now, in terms of whether we're going to be worse off because of the warm winter, it's, you know, you can never get a straight answer from an entomologist because, you know, there's so many different species. Almost any answer will be correct for some species or other. Insects have a real dilemma when it comes to overwintering because they basically are sewn into their winter underwear. They are prepared for the absolute worst. And they are cold-blooded, so when things warm up, they also, their metabolism kicks in. So the problem for an overwintering insect when it's an abnormally warm winter is they become more active and they run out of fuel. They have a limited amount of reserve that's supposed to keep them through the winter months at a low level of activity. If they crank up the activity in January, they may not make it through the winter because, you know, the fuel reserve will get them through, but only at a low level of metabolism. If they come out too early, they could be unpleasantly surprised by a cold snap. So it's not necessarily the case that all garden pests will be worse if the winter's been warm, because some of them actually sort of run out of gas before spring hits.
Real subtle distinctions. Well, WILL is a fun radio station to listen to because you get a perspective on so many aspects of life. One of them, when the agricultural meteorologists talk, they're always in the winter careful to distinguish plain temperature from temperature along with snow cover.
Yep.
Does that work for insects as well?
Absolutely.
We had a wonderful January followed by a sudden crash, but this foot-deep snow cover didn't come until a week after the temperatures had really crunched. Would you expect a difference in the insect effect if it had been reversed? Lots of snow first, then a deep crunch of the temperatures versus what we actually had.
Absolutely.
Falling temperature first and then the snow. I'll hang up at this point and listen.
No, yeah, it's absolutely the case. It's like the difference of, you know, being outdoors in, sort of a sub-zero mountaineering down sleeping bag versus a Barbie pink pretty princess slumber bag, you know. The cold, and again, they have insects have a limited capacity to regulate their body temperatures. They don't have the capacity that we have, that warm-blooded vertebrates have, to generate metabolic heat to keep them going for a long time and maintain their temperature. So when their surrounding temperatures change, they change with them. So if you're, you know, underneath a blanket, you're better off than if you're out there exposed.
Well, I know that I think maybe it was the last time that Sandy Mason was on the show. I think somehow the subject of Japanese beetles came up and there was some speculation about what the winter would mean for them. And I think she or was the other guest said, well, you know, you remember they live pretty deep in the soil. So not only do you have to think about if you're interested in the impact of weather on insects, not only do you have to think about what's the air temperature, well, you also have to think about what's the subsoil temperature and at what level.
Absolutely.
And where they are. And to have an effect on numbers of Japanese beetles, it would have to be really cold. And would have to stay cold for a significant amount of time because that cold has got to penetrate down into the ground to where they are. And that's not just going to happen over a week's time.
Absolutely. There are midges. There's one species of midge, Belgica Arctica, that lives in Antarctica. And you would think that, you know, it would be way too cold most of the year. They actually live in cracks in the ice. And the air temperature in ice cracks is considerably different from the air temperature just a few inches above the soil. So there, when you're tiny like that, your environmental temperature is not what it says at the weather station. So even there are desert beetles, for example, and the soil temperature can be, you know, 120 degrees, 130 degrees. But the Tenebrionid beetles that live in the desert have sort of stilt-like legs. And just 2 centimeters above the desert temperature is like can be 40 degrees cooler. So insects experience a much different world. And you're absolutely right. If you're down deep in the soil, it's not going to be the same conditions as it is just an inch or two below the soil.
Our guest this morning is May Barenbaum. She's professor of entomology here at the U of I. She's head of the department. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and she is someone who is highly regarded in her field as a scientist. I would like to point that out. She has authored a number of books. If you're interested in reading about insects, you might take a look, for example, at her collection Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll. There's also the book Bugs in the System, Insects and Their Impact on Human Affairs, and then the 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, and 99 More Maggots, Mites, and Munchers. And they're both published by the University of Illinois Press. Those might be good if you have children who are interested in learning about insects. Those are really fun, and that might be the kind of thing that you would want to look at. Or if you're interested in a different kind of take on this very issue of insects and the various ways that they and their lives intersect with us and ours, Bugs in the System might be a good one for you to look at there. And if you're in Champaign-Urbana, this weekend on Saturday, it's the 24th Insect Fear Film Festival. The theme this time around is Japanese insect fear films, and they'll be showing 2 Mothra movies. So if you're into giant moths...
And some Japanese anime.
Wrap up your sweaters and then come down to the show. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here in Farina, and that's line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. I'm I feel honored to talk to a real professor.
I wish my students felt the same.
My first exposure to science fiction was through these bubblegum trading cards of Mars Attacks. And one of the things that the Martians did when they invaded was giganticize all the insects. And there's like 52 cards, and one card has a giant green caterpillar on top of the Eiffel Tower, like toppling it. Are you familiar with these cards?
Actually, I'm intrigued by this. What era?
Mars Attacks. It was I don't know if it was Topps or Fleer, but it was right about 59 or 60.
Well, I clearly have to hit the antique stores to find these things. So.
Yeah, and they released a reproduction set on the anniversary. 1990 or so, I don't know when it was. Anyway,
well, it's interesting.
I just wondered if you'd heard of that because it combines science fiction, great drawings of insects. Several of the cards, like there's a black beetle the size of a 48 Buick eating a guy, you know. So anyway, I just wanted to ask you if you'd seen or heard of those cards.
Well, I'm particularly interested in the caterpillar on the Eiffel Tower because there is a scene in Mothra.
Oh, and the thing is, it's all by radiation. So, well, here's a scientific question. Will bugs eventually get bigger through toxic and radiation exposure? And thanks for letting me talk.
Oh, sure. Thanks. Well, actually, there's a scene in Mothra where Mothra climbs up the Tokyo Tower, not the Eiffel Tower. So maybe, I don't know who inspired whom there. Radiation, you know, there's this I don't know if it's an urban legend or is, you know, one of these truisms everyone believes that isn't actually true, that, you know, after the next nuclear blast, the only survivors will be cockroaches. The insects are particularly resistant to radiation. And in fact, today's atom bombs would kill cockroaches just like most other things. They're not exceptionally radiation resistant. Radiation induces mutations. Most mutations are deleterious, so they wouldn't probably do very well. As for being giganticized, there are limits. The reason insects are so successful is that they have a body plan that works for being small, and it doesn't work very well when you sort of blow it up to Buick proportions. They have an oxygen delivery system that is not like ours. We have a circulating fluid that has hemoglobin that carries oxygen around, but they have little pipes that just deliver air to each cell, and doesn't work with a big body plan. When they molt, you know, they have this external skeleton that actually it works well. It takes a while for the skeleton exoskeleton to harden, but when you get very big, the force of gravity actually deforms the new exoskeleton before it can harden, which is one reason that, you know, molting is the most vulnerable time for large arthropods like tarantulas, real life arthropods. If Mothra were real, when she tried to get out of her cocoon, it would be like not a pretty sight. So, the biggest that insects have ever been historically, as far as anybody knows, were Meganeura, sort of proto dragonflies from the Carboniferous era with a wingspan approaching 2 feet. But the thought is that there was a higher concentration of oxygen in the atmosphere then that actually allowed an insect of that size efficient enough oxygen delivery through their tracheal respiratory system to function. And in today's conditions, they would be sort of gasping for breath, I guess, if an insect could gasp, if they were that big. No threat, certainly, to the Tokyo Tower or the Eiffel Tower or any tower.
Okay. And if people are interested, if you can there, I now have a website here where you can see what these look like. And if people have seen Tim Burton's movie, Mars Attacks, you can see that that's where he got these guys. And they look just like the Martians in Tim Burton's movie. But this apparently was a series of trading cards that was created, and I think it said that it was 1962 by the Topps people,
same
which
year
are the
as
famous, famous trading card company, and there are indeed, and they have those guys with the big buggy eyes and the brains inside the little green suits with the air tanks and the thing that looks like they're wearing a fishbowl over their head. So Tim Burton stole it completely from the trading card series from 1962, and it does indeed look like there are some people being attacked here by giant insects.
Well, Pokemon has a number of insect characters that are sometimes recognizable. Caterpie is a, you know, Pokemon's all about transformation, so metamorphosis is a natural for Pokemon characters. Not that I know very much about Pokemon. I have a daughter, not a son. And there is one one insect character called Caterpie who looks just like a Troodine swallowtail. So, it looks just like a swallowtail caterpillar. And Yu-Gi-Oh! Also, we'll be showing a Yu-Gi-Oh! Cartoon. Yu-Gi-Oh! Are trading cards, and there's a character called Insector who summons insect characters to assist him in his battles with Yugi. So, insects are a recurrent theme on collector cards. So.
Okay, very good. Well, and indeed, if people are you can go on the web, and what I did was I think just in the browser I put Mars Attacks trading cards, and eventually I came up with a site that where you can look at all of them. You can see what they look like.
Looks like I have to take a trip to eBay.
I guess. All right. Let's go to Charleston. Talk with someone here. Line number two. Hello.
Yes, I think I heard properly that as the we're protected in weather like we've had last week from the advance of killer bees and other insects, and I think the mosquito that carries West Nile and all that.
No, actually, we've got West Nile. So,
yes. Yeah. Well, that's new, isn't it, in the last 15 years or so?
Exactly.
Well, my question is, I'm kind of taking the reverse here. what's on the other side of the coal line that is permanent? You know, as you get closer to the north and there's got that dividing line and the heat would affect something or insects of some sort that were cold-oriented. I saw a piece on Nature once where these mosquitoes come up and attack the water or the reindeer, I think it is, and only just a very short open space where they can exist, and they do their thing, and then when the cold returns, then they hibernate. Well, however, but what I'm trying to say is if those things that live permanently beyond the frost line, are they affected? Are there species that can't migrate further north, like the polar bear? You know, they're
absolutely
jeopardized now.
Yeah, in fact, this British study that mapped British lepidopterists are incredibly meticulous about documenting butterfly distributions. So there's a very rich database that goes back decades. And these studies that have shown the sort of northward advance of a number of butterfly species have shown exactly what you mentioned, that there has been a contraction of ranges as well for species that are cold adapted. Certain alpine species can't survive if it gets too warm. They are, again, programmed into a life cycle that requires an obligatory chilling period. And if the chilling period isn't cold enough, they can't get through the winter. I work with a little totally inconsequential insect called the parsnip webworm, which feeds on parsnip plants. The weedy form of parsnip. But both parsnip and the parsnip webworm are cold adapted. They can't develop unless they are chilled for a certain number of days. So they are, even though they're both considered the weed is considered a pest and the insect is a pest on parsnip, they don't occur in the southern states at all because it just doesn't get cold enough in the winter. So as warming proceeds, there will be also problems for those species that are limited to cold conditions. So, they're not as charismatic as the polar bear. You don't, see people signing petitions to preserve the parsnip webworm. But there are lots more stories. I'm sure there are many more cases of cold-adapted species that are having trouble with the warmer temperatures.
Yeah, the thing about the mosquito that carries West Nile is that it was able to find spaces in urban environments where it was warm enough where that they where it could overwinter, so that it wouldn't the fact that it was cold outside didn't bother it, because it was, I don't know if it was overwintering in subways or finding places in buildings.
Well, I'm actually not sure, because there are dozens of species that carry West Nile.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
It's not maybe we're talking about well, I mean, there are just dozens of species, and there's a recent introduction in the course of documenting the many, many species that are capable of acting as vectors of West Nile. Among other things, that Aedes japonicus, a new invasive species of mosquito, was found. The most recent major vector of insect of diseases, human diseases, is Aedes albopictus, which had no trouble colonizing northward because it's from the temperate region of Japan. So, the West Nile story, I'm a little confused by, because there are so many different species that can act as vectors. So there's if one can't, there's another one that can fill in. So
okay, well, let's talk with somebody else here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I saw a movie that you might be interested in. Maybe you know about it. It was a long, long time ago. It was sort of part documentary and part horror. It was called The
Hellstrom Chronicles. Oh, it's a classic, yes.
Oh, it's just great.
Yeah.
Have you ever shown that one at your film festival?
Well, here's the problem with Hellstrom Chronicles. In fact, with a lot of these older movies, is that the non-theatrical video exhibition rights are in dispute. Studios have these inventories. They go bankrupt. They sell them to other studios. There are organizations who buy exhibition rights and then rent films, and then they go under because nobody shows movies anymore. It's all video. And there are now, it's such a litigious jumble that, you know, whoever, you can hold up the distribution rights to a film if you just wrote the score, or if you wrote, you know, or there are. So Hellstrom Chronicle is one that you can't even get on. I happen to have it on video, but you can't get it on video because it's in the middle of a legal tangle. But the production story is really interesting. It was filmed as a documentary, a straight nature documentary with spectacular photography for the time. In fact, it beat out The Sorrow and the Sorrow and the Pity in the 1970 Cannes Film Festival. It was so spectacular. But when the studio came to make arrangements for commercial release, they got cold feet and figured Americans will not pay admission price at a theater to see a nature documentary. So they basically went back to the filmmaker and asked him to construct this framing device of the mad Dr. Hellstrom, who is driven insane by this notion that the insects are going to take over the world, and
right,
is trying to get the message out, and nobody. So it's a bizarre film because there's Dr. Hellstrom sort of ranting and raving, and immediately cuts to just absolutely elegant macro photography of actual insect behavior. So it's a real classic. It's just, I wish it weren't probably scarier than vicious insects are litigious lawyers or Hollywood lawyers who can sort of block these films from.
The other thing I might mention, when I was an undergraduate, I took a course in zoology, and we had a collect and classify 30 different insects, and we made our little killing jars, you know. And I got a cockroach and put in there, and nothing happened. And I took it to my professor, and he said, yeah, he said, cyanide won't get these guys. And he picked up the cockroach, took a hypodermic needle, and dropped one drop of strychnine inside the cockroach, and his six little legs just sprang out like they were spring-loaded. But, you know, they've been around since, what, the Devonian, the Permian, something like that.
Probably more likely Carboniferous.
Oh, carboniferous.
350
okay.
years, million years ago.
Oh, that's a mere 350
what's 50
million,
million
years
between friends,
yeah, right?
Well, my cockroach story is, I was actually afraid of insects growing up, but it was not till I took a college course, and the only reason I signed up for that course is that it fit my schedule, that I really came to know and love them. And our first laboratory exercise, we were supposed to dissect the cockroach and expose the dorsal aorta, which is the heart, and observe how the heart responds to different drugs. So this was just a total gross out. And you had to clip off the legs, remove the exoskeleton on the underside, expose this heart, and then we went through a whole series of really potent drugs to watch the heart speed up, slow down, and then at the end, removing the dissecting pins that was keeping this immobile, this mutilated, dissected carcass started swimming away. It was the most just repulsive thing I'd ever seen in my life. So they're not like us. I mean, I'd love them and admire them, but they're really not like us. So they are tough.
Oh, the horror. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. May Barenbaum is here. She is the head of the department. Shockingly enough, she's head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois. And occasionally we talk about insects on the program. And particularly this time of year, we always like to promote the Insect Fear Film Festival. So that's coming up this weekend. We have three, four minutes now. One of the things that you mentioned that you might be interesting to talk about is a bee-related story.
There's a bee crisis, yes.
A bee crisis.
It just recently appeared in the national news. It's a mysterious, disorder. Nobody really knows whether it's a disease or a parasite or environmental chemical, but there are colonies. Well, it's called colony collapse disorder. There are colonies that are mysteriously collapsing. That honeybee colonies typically have 30, 40,000 bees in them. All along in the East Coast, there are honeybee colonies where the workers are just disappearing. There are no dead bodies. They're just disappearing. The beekeepers are up in arms. And you say, why should I care? Well, if you like almonds, you should be afraid. If you like blueberries on your in your pancakes, you should be afraid, because honeybees are responsible for pollinating about 1/3 of American food that's produced. And in fact, honeybees also pollinate the plants that are used as forage for cattle. So the honeybee alone contributes about $15 billion to U.S. agriculture. And there's what's called the migratory beekeeping industry, where the bees are trucked all across the country to provide pollination services for the different crops, orange blossoms, tupelo for honey, over to California for almonds, back to the Northeast for various fruit crops. And the colonies are disappearing. And it really is a crisis facing American agriculture, which people, I don't think, really appreciate the potential magnitude.
I remember that it seems like within the last few years there had been a lot of concern about a mite.
Oh, there is. Well, some people think this may be yet another consequence of the infestation. There are two parasitic mites that devastated insect honeybee colonies. One's called the varroa mite, the vampire mite, which sucks the blood of pupae. And the other is the tracheal mite, lives in the respiratory system and basically gives them sort of bee asthma. And the colony numbers are already in decline. So there's some worries that the honeybee may not be able to function if this disorder isn't quickly recognized and repaired. So it's kind of a quiet crisis, and yet the impact on American agriculture is potentially enormous.
Is the among insects is I'm sure that moths and butterflies do pollinating. Next to the bee, what would be the next most important pollinator?
Well, the thing about the honeybee is it's incredibly Catholic in its taste. It feeds on, it can go to many, many different crops. A lot of other pollinators are extremely specialized. Chocolate, for example, comes from the result of the pollination activity of a tiny little midge, and it's about the only thing that will pollinate cacao, the plant. Figs, if you enjoy Fig Newtons, you have a tiny little wasp to thank. There are little wasps that are the sole pollinators for figs. But the amazing attribute of the honeybee is that it's versatile. It can figure out how to find nectar and collect pollen and deliver pollen to lots and lots of different plants.
Yeah. Well, that's why we have all these different kinds of honey, because the bees take the bees and they then collect pollen from different kinds of plants, and that's why the honey has these different
tastes,
different tastes, which I guess I never really quite appreciated that. And a couple of years ago, I think for the first time, I tried some Tupelo honey. And I love Tupelo honey. I think it's wonderful. And then I tried some others, and I thought, oh, now this is very interesting. They're all really very, very different. And it's just all basically because of the pollen where...
The nectar.
Where the particular plant where they're feeding. And orange blossom honey really it has an orange note in it. And it's very
the reason most Americans don't realize that there's varietal honeys is that most commercial honey is a big gamish from all across the country. It's just cheaper and easier to do it that way. Yeah. There's one more caller? No time.
We can try real quick here. Line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Will this recent really bitter cold snap we've just been going through have any particular effect on general varieties of insects in the coming year, for instance? Is it going to be a better year for most kinds of butterflies, if you can make that kind of generalization, or a better year for mosquitoes in spite of the cold or something like that?
Well, that's the problem with so many different insect species. It's really hard to generalize because there are species that are well-equipped to deal with cold snaps, and there are species that will be knocked out by cold snaps. So it's kind of like the meteorologists who say 50% probabilities, it's hard to generalize across many thousands of species. So there are so many stories out there. It's really hard to know, hard to pin down an entomologist to make a specific prediction.
Well, we will see. I'm sure that as we move into the spring and the summer, May, we'll be back and we'll talk some more. And then also one of these days, Phil Nixon will be here. So if you have a bug problem, we can help you with that. We'll do both of those shows. And we'll just see. And in the meantime, stop by the Insect Fear Film Festival, the 24th. The 24th. And it's on the 24th. How did you work that one out?
That is eerie, isn't it?
at the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus on the Quad on Saturday, showing two Mothra films and an animated Japanese animated short. And there'll be an insect petting zoo. And it's free and open to anybody. Good family event. So stop by.
Thanks a million.
Thank you. May Barenbaum. She's the head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois.